Good morning. It's going to be a small and intimate group. I'm pleased to introduce Sunil Bhatia, who's Professor of Human Development here at the college. He joined the Kennedy community in 1999. He is the recipient of the 2005 John S. King Faculty Award for Excellence in Teaching, and in 2009 he received the Martin Luther King Jr. Faculty Service Award. He served as the director of the Holleran Center for Community Action and Public Policy from 2008 to 2011. His courses include language, narrative, and self and ethnography, and the construction of self and identity. Bhatia holds a BA and MA from the University of Pune in India, and a Master of Education and PhD from Clark University. Please welcome.
Thank you, Nayib. Where in India is it? Pune, University of Pune. It's near Bombay, just south. Southwest,
yeah.
Being here now 12, this is my 13th year.
We went to India a year or so, but only when tourists.
Can I invite you to come to the front?
Sure, absolutely.
We can have a one-on-one discussion.
Yes.
Those children are smart.
Yeah.
Those my husband Bill.
And I'm not presenting college. I met my wife here before there were men allowed.
Were you at the Coast Guard Academy or?
No, I was the United States Naval Academy and Harvard Business School, and I was living on a submarine for 4 years across.
Oh,
home ported out of there. We were out in the North Atlantic most of the year. But
that's how I met.
Yeah. Well, I'm sorry. Women weren't allowed into a lot of Ivy League schools back in the 50s. And my wife wanted to go to Yale because her father and a couple of uncles went there. And but she was not allowed to be a spy at Yale. And I'm very, very happy about that because if she'd gone to Yale, Business School, and the last year I was there was the first year that six women were allowed from Radcliffe were allowed to audit one in each of the six sections. And this is the 50th reunion, 50 from 16, yeah. The first woman to graduate from women's class with a degree from Harvard Business School.
So you have the distinction that he chose Connecticut College and not a Radcliffe woman.
one of the more challenging courses at Harvard Business School was written analysis of cases.
Yeah.
And my wife deserves the credit for getting me a distinction grade in that class. She was the editor. And the girls from Radcliffe was great. Analysis, but I had somebody to edit them for you.
Those are days of the manual type.
So I think this would be very relevant for us to talk to because this entirely when we're talking about social media, so you're even pre-television.
Right.
Yeah.
Television
so,
is not
a
part of the life.
I don't want to mark your life, but I'd love to talk to you because I grew up in a very kind of pre-television age, yeah. The way our society was structured in India, too.
I grew up in Aruba, which was a follow-up, which is an island off. And of course, no television and no radio, really, just shortwave, so we didn't even have radio. So we just had books and life.
Let me get to Brian.
Oh, well, after law school, I went down to New York for City for a graduate degree, and I met Sally and Blind Date, our roommates, got us together. And the rest is history.
Who's history?
history. We were in India during the Festival of Lights.
You were in
the biggest.
So did you say CUNY? What was the university? In New York?
NYU.
NYU. Many of our students go there for their master's. So we have a limited time here, and what I thought was I was going to start you off with a reading, so I'll simulate actually a class of how what I would do in a normal class that I would give students readings as they come, and then we usually hold a discussion. So I have this idea, why not give alumni who here, also something to read, and then we can have a discussion about the reading. It's a very brief reading, and it's called The Joy of Quiet. And then we can get to the larger theme of reflections on social identity. Okay.
Yeah, a lot of writers get up early in the morning.
Right.
Yeah,
let me give you a brief background about what this article means and why I gave it to you, and then you can, I'm very interested in what you think about this. My students, I teach a class on social media identity, the impact of social media. You see most of our students today are saturated with media. They're also called something like digital natives, there's a term. Those who are born and saturated, and this is something that comes very naturally to them. Since they were born in this world, mm-hmm. Yeah. They have always been in some way interacting with what we on-screen time. And now, the on-screen time is about 10 hours to 11 hours a day, so which means they go from video to television to texting to phone to doing their work on computers to going to YouTube to Facebook. So, and this is sort of what scholars talk about, this idea that there's a difference between what we call an online self, a self that you create in the digital world, and then what impact does it have on sort of offline self when you switch it off? Now, none of you, I assume, when you were growing up, had an online self. You had a different imaginary self. You had a self, what we call a possible self, when you were 15, 16. You thought this is how it would be. But you could only think so much in the future.
But it came more from reading.
So it came from reading, it came from interactions, before I give them this reading, I actually make them do a media journal diary that they have to write for a whole week. How much media do they consume? So I give them a matrix, tell me how much, and then you bring to the class. Divide your time up for 24 hours. Whatever you do, anytime you're engaging with screen time, you have to write that down. And many of the students have never been aware of this process of actually looking at how much time they use media, because their self, as he's saying, is fused with the media. There is no separation between self and the world anymore. So what they tend to do when they come is they're very disturbed and actually angry that I made them do this. Because they already realized, and my student just about 6 weeks ago when I made this, most of the students had 9:14, 9:15, 9:18, 10:20, sent a text, checked a text. So one student sent about 100 a day, and then one of the other students told me that she had, in the middle of the night, taken a picture of a frozen yogurt and just decided to tweet and put it on Facebook. She doesn't know why, but it was. And then she got even comments on it. And then she discussed that in class as well. And then we discussed this idea. So what the basic question that I'm trying to get to at the more research level is, what does it do to your attention? There's this idea of not so much attention deficit anymore, but attention dispersion. So your attention, the fact that you're multitasking, multi-engaged with all this. So where do you have this time to fight the space for reflection, self-reflexivity, quiet, this idea of solitude, someone would argue, our civilization, so to speak, is built on this idea of solitude. You came here to liberal arts college. That was a place where you pursued ideas in solitude. That was the idea. It doesn't mean you were always in solitude, but you've never had these kinds of distractions. So the question of attention deficit is no longer, or attention dispersion is no longer just a question of theory. There's enough research to say now that from neuroscientific findings that your brain cannot multitask. And I was going to show you a video, but we don't have the time and enough experiments done to say that at this point in time, we know, for example, our students, especially our children, this tomorrow, so to speak, that all this engagement with media, multimedia, screen time is having a negative impact in terms of their attention dispersion. Attention dispersion actually can be understood in a very simple metaphor. So you take a glass of water, put water in and fill it up. So the more deeper the water is, the better your attention is. So, but if you take a pan and you take that same water and put it in a pan, it gets distributed and the water becomes shallow. So one is, in order to have depth of attention, you have to do only one thing at a time, is one of the sort of proposed hypotheses. Or you can do maybe two. After that, your efficiency decreases, ability to concentrate, and so on. So while the technologies have been great, I don't want to sound, give you moral panics about it. It's transformed every part of our life in some ways, as you know. From people getting married to having things like cyber sex, you know, all the things that you can think about have changed. I mean, there are revolutions. You can think about the Arab Spring, where Facebook has been so important, social media and connecting with people. More than 50% of the people who meet and get married right now happens first online. So while there have been some great advances, we definitely know people can communicate, get together. We think of this as a transnational global village and so on. But at the same time, what he's pointing to is the fact that we are not yet ready for the unintended consequences of what technology does to human relationships. So I would be interested in your thoughts. That's the kind of background from where I'm coming when I give my student. So what did you think of this?
You know, you reminded me of our house in Cape Cod when we first built it. We built a summer house, and we essentially banned TV because we thought there were a few weeks being disconnected from the TV would be a positive thing.
Right.
This year, one of the first things we made sure that was done was that the cable TV was hooked up. And not only that, after the TV, and the computer too, and, but not only that, as time went on and we did get TV there, and now we have to have high def TV.
Yeah.
Because the grandchildren really, I don't think they could really be comfortable with completely zero TV over several weekends.
So with TV, we have regulations, and there's enough research of 50 years now to say that the more exposed children are to TV, they're declining literacy skills, declining reading, math. So that is, research has been very established.
Exercise.
Yeah, exercise, all of those. This is new territory for us. This is only 6 years old. Facebook, YouTube is new. And we are just beginning to understand what it is doing to our collective society and human relationships most.
Well, I have one comment. Yeah. I talked to a few friends who went to college.
Yeah.
She said when she picks up a grandchild every day from school and to take him somewhere.
Yeah.
And can't talk to him.
Right.
Guess what? She's got this little thing there, and that's what he wants to deal with.
Right.
And she would try to say, well, how did things go today?
They didn't schedule for things very poorly, so I just thought I would be
Yeah, glad you're here. Yeah.
So I'm not sure what I missed or not. You've been coming up.
We just started the
way. Thank you.
This was the reading I gave them, looking at the impact of social media, especially on issues of attention deficit, screen time, what media is doing for our kids in terms of their development.
Very interesting. I'm a teacher.
Yes.
I see these kids like have no attention span. Yeah.
So, yes, other questions?
I was going to say, my favorite vacation is camping, where we have no connection, no electricity, no nothing. And now we have a beach house, and we deliberately, I don't bring a computer because I don't want to have to deal with that. And until last year, we didn't have a television set.
Uh-huh.
Now we do a very old one, very small, and it's not too inviting to spend a lot of time watching.
Well, it was fascinating you mentioned. He actually has a comment that corporations, not companies, are planning what they call media free vacations.
Mm-hmm.
So it's something that you have to, by design and intention,
yeah.
So you come to that point. Media free vacations. So
both media free vacations.
Yes, so Wi-Fi. It's fascinating. 10 years ago, everybody was clamoring for Wi-Fi in the coffee shop. Now in Japan and places in India too, you actually say, this is not a Wi-Fi. So the very thing, Wi-Fi, which we aspire for, which allows you to connect, is now seen as a distraction. It's something that interferes because you sit at the computer. It's a very different notion of a coffee shop. You go to Starbucks, everybody is on their screen.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, they're talking to each other.
It's very antisocial.
Yeah. So those are some of the things he's
talking
about.
There's more than one category of this technological communication.
Yeah.
And I really can't function without my laptop and the ability to see what's happening with
Correct.
My account.
Yeah, sure, exactly.
But the social media is a different story.
Correct. Yeah.
And I
we don't do that.
Yeah. We don't do it, no. And I'm fascinated by the addiction that people have with texting or driving a car.
Right.
I don't quite understand this.
Yeah.
But I really can't function without some connection.
Correct.
To various things.
Yes, there's a kind of utilitarian, pragmatic, correct. So I think what you pointed out is really useful, and that's why I said earlier that it's no longer anymore that you are engaging with this media, but there is a means-end relationship, and it's an instrument to accomplish goals. Yeah. But now it's fused entirely in every aspect of your life. So Mark Zuckerberg, when he started Facebook, he had this comment, I want the world, and Facebook comes out, start their day by switching on to Facebook and end their day by switching off to Facebook. And he has pretty much succeeded that. We have 900 million individuals now, where it's a strong social network. But the question is what both, I mean, he's raising this very interesting question, and there's another article I'll probably give it to you, can read later on, that's called The End of Solitude. So on the one hand, all the social media was intended to create more intimacy with others. What has happened is creating more intimacy with the tools. What the point is not necessarily with the other person who's at the end of the tool. That's one. So neither do these individuals have the intimacy, and neither do the individuals have the solitude. So on both ends that are really needed for what we call optimal human development are in some ways, at this point in time, the book that I use is Sherry Turkle's book called Alone Together. She beautifully puts it together, that you are alone, but at the same time together. So she has this very novel concept. She called this idea, which is developed actually by a Microsoft executive, called partial continuous attention, which means your attention is there, but it's always partial and it's always continuous. So if you look at the neuroscientific studies, on the one hand, it says it's not possible to multitask. So this experiment that I show a video in my class, where students from MIT or Stanford researcher looked at them and gave them all the experiments to know how efficient and productive they are as they're engaging with different kinds of tasks. Most of them weren't able to. They had very high understanding that they were multitasking, but the idea that you can multitask only one or two, but continuously, is your brain, of course, is just not able to process it and handle it. So that research is fairly well established now. So once you put that research on attention and then look at all this, your mediation, then the question becomes about, it's not just so much about being quiet, but why do you need the space to be quiet? That's the big part. That's what he's explaining. And that's, so why, what are the benefits then? That's the question, when I ask my students. They resonate with it. This really works with them. They really read this and say, yeah, there is something here. And their experience is that they are constantly connected, so that they're able to say that I feel very agitated, I feel quite restless, this idea of quiet. I really don't fully understand what is supposed to do, because they constantly, so the way they do it, they write a paper, they write a few minutes of paper, and then they'll check their Facebook, check their text. Right. And so one of the researchers found that even they don't have transition points anymore in their paragraphs. They have bursts of information that come, but they're not able to put it together in a way that's very cohesive.
Yeah.
So and much of the research, especially the book that I use, it's called Alone Term, as I said before, is raising these questions very fundamental about self, about identity. So what is it doing to you? And your generation sort of passed by. Much of this even came after my dinner. Even up to 1999, I taught a class there where there were no cell phones. Up to 2004, I remember, a class, I didn't have a statement in my syllabus that you're not allowed to bring cell phones in. But now I have a two-paragraph explicit statement about computer, unless you have some form of disability and so on. So, and I tell them about the benefits. So this is a media class, but the way it works is that I actually have to take them away from media for them to give them the space to even understand what media is. So I start by giving the example of fish in water. They never kind of understand the quality of what water is. So unless and until I don't remove them from it, it's very hard. And they actually quite appreciate it after 2 weeks. They become very sensitive to the fact that, yeah, this actually gives him more space to talk about in class without having to
you know, looking at Facebook and so on, because I'm automatically cutting it for them and creating an environment where we can have a conversation for the very things that people I was talking about.
Do you get them to actually try on their own time to
yes.
use this lesson? Yes. Yeah. Let's just use the word experiment.
Yeah.
What would it be like just living the old days?
Yeah, I think...
Without any of the screens.
Yeah.
I mean, I was wondering if you had even tested that out.
I think it's very hard.
And you need it for the
correct, correct.
You need it for,
absolutely.
For homework, and you need it for school. But aside from that, you don't need
yeah.
other stuff.
And what I tell them is that this technology is here to stay. Like television. Remember when television came, there was all this moral panics about what television is going to do to our relations.
Oh, yeah.
And then you had New York had this cartoon of electronic, they call it the electronic storyteller. And you had all the family sitting, you know, and looking at, this became the center, the sacred spot. Furniture was arranged depending on where the television was. So there was quite a bit, even when phone came, even when the printing press came, every new technology that comes into our society reorganizes our sets of relationships.
Radio too.
Yeah, I think even the way we understood individuals, the way they heard the sports game, like baseball. Many individuals I know who grew up listening to radio don't like actually television. They find actually radio baseball. Commentary through radio far actually are more engaging and challenging because they have to imagine.
Yes.
Because this aspect of imagination is taken away from them. Yeah, so that's one of the questions which most of these individuals are asking today is, what is this children if you're going to think 20, 30 years? And if we don't do something about the screen time, you know, what? So one area that I think has been very instrumental, especially the field that I study in, is human development. And there the idea is, for the last 100 years, you might have heard of the psychologist Erickson, right? Eric Erickson. He came up with this notion of identity crisis in when you are 14, 15. Adolescence is full of the times when you have these, you know, huge pendulum swings and you are, who am I? You're confronted with this question about when you're in self-discovery, self-actualization, you think about possible selves and so on. And then he also came up, much of our Western ideas of human development is based on this idea of autonomy, that to have a mature self, you have to in some ways be separated from others. You have to come to decisions through self-reflection. You have to be able to understand yourself through others, but at the same time, you have to have the space in which you engage with your own thoughts. So part of good emotional development is being able to reason and come to some conclusions about what's happening in yourself. That's the kind of level of maturity we talk about, somebody who's mature. Now, what these individuals who are working in media are looking at how, if you're constantly connected 24 hours, then what does it really do to your emotional development? So Sherry Turkle, who is a psychologist at MIT, talks about this idea that our kids don't necessarily get the space to understand, to be disconnected. They find solitude very scary. But it's important for human development at the same time. Much of our civilization has always cherished this idea of reflection, and it's learning through reflection, and also coming to some kind of crystal clarity in decision making. But if you're constantly, so there are two things that she talks about very fascinating. One is, what is the consequences of 24/7 when you're sending 100 texts, 50 texts? The moment you send a text, what do you think you're waiting for? A response. So she talks about, she looked at these kids and did about 15 years, she's tracked them. In the very first pioneering work from 1990, and she says, comes to this conclusion that this generation is very dependent on what she says, feedback. Mm-hmm. So they need constant feedback. And if they don't get, they send a text and they don't get something back,
they get anxious.
So she talks to us, and I'll show you a slide, she talks about this, so there's new forms of anxiety. So with technology, also comes. And there's other one she's talking about called fear of missing out, formal it's called. That at 20, that you can go to a party at 1 and actually take pictures and simultaneously upload it onto your Facebook. And if you're studying, you're on Facebook, you get this picture from your friend,
she talks about this idea that you're suddenly feeling disengaged from other forms of vacation pictures, what people put out. So this idea that she talks about is that identity is almost constructed. It allows you, like a construction set. So, but the issue is that you also can use this to form what she called as idealized forms of yourself. So the most idealized form, the way you look, you can even Photoshop yourself. And the most idealized selective representation, you can put yourself on it. So it gives you, so each person actually is like a little celebrity. They have their own little fan page, you know, and then they have to update it and you construct it. And that is this idea of continuous. So you're also, the question is not so much about who am I, but how do I brand myself, is a different question. So it's not an existential question necessarily, but also. So once you're connected 24 hours, so you start to see, for example, these kind of damaging consequences to some extent. On your ability to fulfill tasks, responsibilities, deep thinking, is another one. And so they're trying to map out current research in all areas. There are, of course, benefits that we know, that we talked about. You can instantly today, you can download, if you want to learn a guitar, you can go out to YouTube and do 101. There are so many different ways in which, if you want to, the most simplest thing, anything you want to do, accomplish, know about. You have you heard of Khan Academy?
Yes, for that.
Yeah, so you have, he teaches he's put in close to 3,000 lectures.
Yeah.
It's
pretty good.
And they're very good. Mine is my own son, and there's fractions. I put that on, it's free. 3 million to 6 million individuals.
What is it called again?
Khan Academy.
C-O-N-S?
K-H-N. Yeah, he's a...
It's just a great way of teaching.
So you see these kind of effects now that we call the digital generation that we kind of related to. So one is actually, because they have not yet figured out how much of it is time wasting and entertainment, and how much of it actually is profoundly helping them learn. In many ways. So those are things you're parsing out. So I'll just take a pause and ask you for comments. Any of this resonate with you, maybe?
Well, I can do two vignettes.
Yeah.
Dying. Mm-hmm. And several decades ago, we knew a family.
Mm-hmm.
And the father would insist that no one answered the telephone during mm-hmm. the dinner.
Yeah.
He wanted to talk. With the family, you
right.
couldn't read. You had to. You couldn't answer the telephone. There were no cell phones then.
Right.
Recently, we went to a restaurant, and there were two teenagers there, and a father. One teenager had two appliances they were trying to do. Two handhelds they were right. doing simultaneously. Right. The other teenager had theirs, and nobody was talking.
Right.
Remember the restaurant? But just.
Those are the images of our times now. Go to airports, restaurants, conferences.
And maybe a decade ago, we went to Japan, mm-hmm. and we got on a bus that some school kids came on. And the girl in the seat in front of us was talking on her cell phone. We finally figured out she was talking to her friend, which was two seats up on the other side.
It happens.
They didn't get a seat together.
Roommates do that all the time. Yeah. Students tell you that they can't speak together.
So when you have your students do this digital media diary,
yeah.
are they appalled?
They are, as I said, they come in disturbed.
Right.
And very highly reflective.
But does that last?
Well, that's the question we have to ask is what he's raising. Do you have to then create environments now? Where you make sure that our students are experiencing the joys of quiet, where there is no attention dispersion, where they actually are very much present and focused very systematically in the present and pursuing activities, or, like having what the news used to call this ideal flow, they're in the zone. So that experience, for many of our students actually tell me they don't have that experience. And then, as a human development, a psychologist, you're actually looking at what does that do to your identity, one that way.
But then there's also actual issues related to learning. You know, on one hand, online learning is great. The question is, when do you switch off? My students, you know, Sherry Turkle talks about this idea called phantom vibration. So our students hear phantom, and they put the phone down. There's no vibrations coming, but they actually feel the phones going off, so they keep checking to what's happening. Yeah, and they resonate with that, right? Idea of phantom migration, right? You know, in this field. So that's one. And then they also talk about this very fascinating process where they now do social activities in life which actually look good on Facebook. So it's not that
interesting.
You think about what vacation do I take. It's not so well articulated and thought out and so intentional. It's a part of them they were saying that when you go to certain places, you think, you know, this would be great on the Facebook. Should I upload it now? Mm-hmm. This would invite comments. So there's a lot of conversation about when you put things up. Because see, what does Facebook do? It asks you the simple question, what is on your mind? What do you want to share? Mm-hmm. So you know what a clutter of our mind is. Mm-hmm. Buddhists call it monkey mind. Yeah. And it's constantly distracted, constant conversations and thoughts now. And so, if you don't have these outlets, sort of usually chatter is going on in our brain. If you're fairly good at knowing, we engage with some, and some we bracket it out. But if you get a medium whereby you can express this constant chatter, so things like, my students do things like when they're waking up from a class and coming to waking up from their dorm and coming to class, they do things like going to class right now across the green, where they're really good. Not sure why I'm at Connecticut College. Things like very metaphysical statements too, you know, yeah. Or I had some time ago, a couple of my students, a very interesting picture of a rat, actually a mouse in a toilet. And she put this picture on that. And now imagine you see a mouse in the toilet, and the first thing you see is, let me take a picture of it. So I can put it on the face. When do you think, you know, you could even imagine this time would have come where you take. So I have other friends, colleagues who are documenting the entire pregnancy on Facebook. From the pictures or something, you know, sonograms.
Who's that little finger?
Yes,
psychological interview, mm-hmm. than having it all on. That's all very private. And there's the other aspect of the privacy, and it's the security.
Correct, yeah.
Those are, I find it hard to comprehend.
That's the question we're saying, this is where you see a developmental shift in this generation, and the generation did not have access. So then privacy means something else. Self-disclosure means a very different thing than what the generation, two generations even prior to what it means to you.
So people get upset about having their phones tapped.
Yeah.
Immediately, yet
yeah.
They're tapping them themselves. They're tapping their mind.
So they're very aware that Facebook to some level is using, there's this notion of digital footprint. Mm-hmm. Wherever you go, you leave a footprint. And in the same article that I give them, they also really call how Facebook is using you for generating revenue, all kinds of things in terms of advertising.
About 2 weeks ago, the Science Times, they had a big front page article on that scientists do not have access to this information.
And there is also, so there's a very different concept of human privacy. Mm-hmm. So what does privacy mean to you? What does it mean to you?
Not Facebook,
right? Would you post things such as, I'm thinking.
I made an effort to erase Google from all my computers. I have three computers. And I find Google very intrusive. And the other day I went on, I used Bing for Microsoft, because I don't like it. Because of the privacy aspect, and I got a map thing. And the next thing I have on my screen is a thing from Google
an effort that Google offers. It says, if you'll get your directions from Google, Google crack your entire trip for you.
Yeah.
And my first thought was, I don't want Google to crack my entire trip because I don't know who you're going to sell.
Right. Exactly. And I think a lot of students, many of them are aware, but have not yet thought about fully the consequences of even putting certain pictures up, which compromises them with employers.
That's why they're saying, right?
Okay. So there's some awareness that happened within 5 years with this generation as well. But at the same time, the bigger question for them is, this is the medium now by which they engage socially for the most of the time. So we look at, so when we look about 10 hours, 12 hours, and that level of engagement that we do on in the social media, much of it is also anonymous. So the big question is, what does it mean for your emotional and cognitive development? Because intimacy demands taking certain risks when you look at people face to face. It's a very different level of communication. So that's what he's raising. So Facebook gives you the tool to communicate, but at the same time, it is kind of risk-free communication. It does not necessarily develop intimacy. It's a way of the kind we know.
Dumping
your
boyfriend.
Yeah, those kinds as well. Yes. Or giving anonymous comments is one, or even this whole idea of liking something. Maybe like something. So that's a big question. Metaphysically, you can think about what does it mean. You know, when you've been, and something's structured for you, don't have any options to state much. It's already there, you click that, and that's an interesting. And I think one part which I think we should talk about is the addiction that image is coming from you, Barbara.
Yes.
Yeah, Barbara. Yes. Yeah. So what he says is that some in South Korea they have internet rescue camps right now for 10 days, and that I actually showed this in the video, which my students go and watch it. In South Korea. So this, I would recommend. I was going to show you. Yeah, it is. So now, it's called Digital Nation. This documentary made by a friend of mine, and they're trying for kids in South Korea. Many of them do video games on screen, or they just don't know how to disengage.
Well, it's funny. I have a colleague who's a little bit older than I am, but he has young children. His daughter is at the University of Connecticut. Mm-hmm. And she was placed in a roommate situation whereby she really didn't connect with them. And she's now a senior, and she hasn't been able to connect with people. She doesn't drink in any of those parties. Because wherever she is, they're always on their computer or on their iPhone, and nobody's talking to each other.
Yes, it sort of raises two questions. Is on one level, we've got this technology that we wanted to create all these communication devices. So one is altered our form of communication, the way we talk, the way we write, with Skyping. So you have in India, you know, right now you can outsource. So there's all the revolution in India and China. So our work life, for example, is very different. People, and I went to, I'm working on a book project right now, and I went to this call center in India. You have portals where you're working. So there's a team in South Africa, Ireland, and the United States. This individual actually has never left a city. He doesn't need to. All the work gets done right now, back and forth, being sent on the computer, but also their meetings are essentially virtual meetings where they figure out problems. So that's
brainstorming.
Yeah. So there's this whole other aspect that the media opens up access, but at the same time it also constrains human communication in other ways and can actually overpower. And at some point in time, you would then have to figure out whether this technology that we intended to have, that we call advanced technology, in what ways actually it is a counterpoint, or it, to some extent, it is having some of these unintended, what we call negative effects, so to speak, on human communication, interpersonal relationships, idea of intimacy, learning. So it's fascinating that in Google, especially in preschool, and in their employees, and their kids send their kids to school there, I think up to third grade, they don't allow any technology, so they're not allowed. In most of the schools, they've made a decision not to. This is
This is where the most of the most innovative technology has been developed. Mm-hmm. So it's not that they're in on something, but they also know that a technology ultimately is a tool. It facilitates, it's a media ultimately, it allows us to do all these kinds of things. But the point Pico Iyer and some others are making is now is our entire connection is to the technology only. And then what does that mean? What are the consequences for learning? Even simple things like attention are sifting information. What is junk? What is knowledge? How do you teach? So I think much of the time you have to actually talk to students about that.
When you say Google doesn't allow any media, I don't know if you said media or technology in the classroom.
In the, for kids, it was an article.
But they still use projection.
Yes, yes. This is an article in your time you had. Send it to you. It was mostly on how they're very conscious of the fact that children of all these studies that have been going on, that doesn't necessarily facilitate learning. It may come at another point in time, but their formative experiences of learning, this is the preschool, does not necessarily have this external media that we can talk about. So things like collaborative play still encouraged. Things like parallel play, solitary play, those other earlier forms of play. So there's another psychologist, actually a historian at Brown University, who wrote this fascinating book, which some of my students read, and that book's called Children at Play. So he's looking at the history of play over 500 years in the United States. In the last chapter, he said that for the longest time, play, imaginative play, all forms of play, street play, backyard play, some of it has been structured and unstructured. But it's the first time in the last 10 years or so, you see what young kids want, 12, 13-year-olds, are the same toys that adults want. So the aspirational category actually has compressed. And it's very true, if you talk to 12, 13-year-olds, they're constantly talking about the newest form of technology, iPads. What excites them, what they think is novel, what they think is, because play is considered a manipulation of something that brings novelty in the circumstance. So it gives you pleasure. It could be climbing a tree, it could be. But this form of play is very new now, for example. So he says that, and this generation prior to that, their fathers were raised, for example, on this form of play, of watching video games, playing. And so many of them that talk around houses to sort of look at the newest form of the gadget. It doesn't mean that it's exclusively that, but it's taking over. And for example, my son who's 10 and my daughter, we have to be very conscious of media use and how it's affecting their own behavior, how it affects their ability to even interpersonally communicate with each other. They're constantly, because the first thing they want to come home and sometimes is their town time is to want to play a Wii, for example, you know, or take their computer little things.
Exactly, like Rachel. Yeah, so they don't talk to me much. Yeah.
So there is this part of as psychologists where we want to be very clear that, you know, it's opened up this amazing, profound moments of learning. My son uses the Google Earth to look at geography. He can go to different parts of my home, you know, I grew up, was raised. He can take the Google Earth right there and say, hey, you know, Dad, that's where you were born. Yeah, and then he can communicate with other individuals across every Saturday because he's very attached to his grandmother. And so he's learning the Indian classical instrument, the tabla. Mm-hmm. You know, so he does a performance for his grandmother every 2 weeks on Skype in India. Yes. And she has her own computer and she's sitting having a cup of tea. And he's been able to, and then my daughter comes in and chats. And I have, and this is entirely set up by them. I have no control over it.
That's good.
So that's the puzzle. That's the puzzle. So I want us to be very clear.
It's definitely a substitute.
Yeah. So you can see that it is. This is fairly profound in terms of those who have been following events in the Middle East. Where Facebook did not cause the relationship, but uses a technology.
Without Facebook, I don't think.
Yeah. Or you know, text to mobilize people. Yeah. Collectively mobilize and organize people for a cause. Now has opened up in ways. Have us talk about ecology, environment, talk about, you know, human rights, for example. So there are ways in which you can bring certain areas, you know, journalism,
fascinating, what we call common man journalism videos that are coming out of Syria right now. You know, when there are oppressive governments are trying to subdue any kind of protest. You have, for example, local people, while they're getting shot, taking out their cell phone and recording the last moments. So you have certain kind of access to scenes, and it's 24 hours now. So while that it is, the question then is, what else of training do you need to give this generation on how to engage and also disengage? That's a lot of question.
In the old days, Sumahal would be a lot of game time.
Yeah.
Now I'm beginning to think there won't be much of that. Right.
How do you have your children organize their time in respect to how much time they can be on the media?
I only give them weekends. So nothing Monday to Friday, no television show.
I think they can control it.
Yeah, and when it is, there are summits for good purposes, for doing homework, but then they can have a few hours. And it's never more than 2 to 3 hours on a weekend. And that includes watching sports, playing games, you know, whatever. But it has to be monitored, but they also know that now.
2 to 3 hours including TV or not?
Including everything, the screen time, for a whole weekend. But it's a struggle.
I see it with my friends.
Peer pressure. But money, they're very good about it. They know it entirely. So
they talk to each other.
They do talk to each other, and they're very aware of the language and vocabulary. You know, I've taught them that it has detrimental effects too. You know, they're very easily things like, you know, they feel very hyper. And then there's like a separate event to calm down. You know? So they at least got the vocabulary to think about it. About what this is doing and so on, you know. But it's just something you constantly monitor as a parent and negotiate, because if left to their default world, they would want to be with this. But they're also good readers, I don't want to say that. They're also loved to read and read. Yeah, and there are other kids we also know there.
They just had 10 television to deal with them. It's so much harder on parents now.
Yeah.
So much easier.
I think we can continue this conversation, but I also know you have somebody else to go to.
That was really interesting.
Thank you.